Welcome to Feminist Magazine, a radical weekly show bringing you radio by, for, and about women. Every Tuesday, you're going to hear stories and programming created and curated by our coalition of feminists, including activists, artists, educators, mothers, journalists, and more.
Every week, we share stories that matter to us and to you, from grassroots to global, about women making a radical difference. Stories you haven't heard and new views on key issues from an intersectional feminist perspective. We highlight art, culture, and news, and voices of women from all walks of life, organizing, making change, and kicking some ass.
This afternoon, we're inviting you to explore using the word ally as a verb instead of a noun. Eradicating racism is an inside job, and we're bringing you Witnessing Whiteness, the need to talk about race and how to do it, with feminist anti-racist activist Shelley Touchluck. She unravels some knots and describes how to work within white communities.
Then, full-time sass machine and feminist blogger Marina Watanabe from Feminist Fridays on Everyday Feminism gives us her take on how to be an ally to black movements.
And we're bringing you poet Claudia Rankine's meditation on race. Citizen, an American Lyric, is a new stage adaptation of her internationally acclaimed book of poetry about everyday acts of racism in America. Director Shirley Jo Finney weighs in, and then Nikki Crawford and Monet Michael perform live in studio.
And we'll do a ticket giveaway to Citizen. And we're bringing you music by Adrian Brown, Rock Solid, with Annie May. We're your hosts, Ariana Manoff and Cesse Abejon, and this is What Feminism Sounds Like.
Now, I know it was Gandhi who said, "We must become the change we wish to see in the world." But I've always thought it should be one of our feminist mantras. And we all know we need to keep on schooling each other, mm-hmm. in spite of the fact that sometimes we suck at it. Anyway, we need to keep finding more effective tools for eradicating inequality, and this interview with a local Los Angeles activist is yet another tiny step.
My name is Dr. Anne, and this is Safe Space Radio, a show about the subjects we would struggle with less if we could talk about them more. Today is part of our ongoing series on white privilege and white racism in Maine and how we can talk about it. My guest is Shelley Touchluck, a professor of education at Mount St. Mary's College in Los Angeles, and the author of the book Witnessing Whiteness, The Need to Talk About Race and How to Do It. She specializes in white racial identity and how it affects our interactions within and across race. Welcome to Safe Space Radio, Shelley.
Thank you.
I'd like to start by asking you, what is it about race and racism that makes it so hard for white people to talk about it?
Well, from my experience and all of the variety of people that I've spoken to who are, you know, self-identified as white, a lot has to do with just how we're trained to think about race at all and how we're trained to think about ourselves in relationship to race. I think one of the foundational elements is that our country is sort of defined by this idea that we all get where we go based on our own merit and everything is based on, you know, our personal responsibility. And so we tend, and I'm speaking specifically of white people, to think of ourselves not as part of a racial group, but as strictly individuals. And that's a very different experience than most people of color who, by virtue of continuing, ongoing, subtle or overt racism, end up receiving a message very clearly that they are part of a group, representing a group in some way, and that they are marked by their race. And so I think that difference means that for white people growing up, we tend not to be thinking of race as a very salient thing. We tend not to talk about it too much in reference to ourselves. And therefore, I think we don't get good at it. We don't get good at understanding the nuances of race and how it plays a role in our lives.
So I appreciate that. So that's a really benign reason in some ways. You're saying we're socialized to not think of ourselves as belonging to a racial group. We don't get many chances to practice. I'm guessing there's other reasons, too.
Yes, I think there another big key component is that we are taught that the correct way to approach issues of race in our society is to be colorblind. And this idea of being colorblind has problems that a lot of us don't recognize. By saying that I'm colorblind, I'm essentially giving people a message that I don't see myself in terms of race, and therefore I'm unlikely to see how racism might actually have been in sort of ingested in me unconsciously. And so if I'm not thinking about it or paying attention to it, I'm actually more likely to have those unconscious elements stay unconscious, which leads to the problem that I'm actually maybe more likely to step on toes without realizing it, and the consequence is be defensive if I'm called on it, because, hey, after all, I'm colorblind. And if I'm approaching the world in a colorblind way, I'm also unlikely to be paying attention to how our systems still continue to perpetuate racism, in which case if someone comes to me expressing that they believe that a system or some policy or an institution has racism within it, I'm unlikely to also be paying attention to that, possibly unlikely to hear it.
Right, and therefore maybe oblivious to how that's impacting a person of color's everyday life.
Right, and my first thought was, is that really true? I didn't know if I believed it or not. And so I went and asked a few of my friends who are people of color from various backgrounds, and each of them said, oh, yeah, that's exactly what's going on. That's exactly how it comes off, and that's exactly the message that we receive when I'm colorblind ends up being mentioned. And so what I started doing was incorporating that understanding into some of the conversations I was having with other people. And after the book got published, I started getting asked to do some presentations on occasion. And I was telling this story once at a presentation, and I saw in the first row there was maybe a middle-aged woman sitting with her friend, a white woman and a black woman, and both of them appeared to be, oh, I don't know, maybe in their mid-50s. And as I continued to speak and tell about my revelation, the white woman began to cry intensely, and the black woman put her arm around her and just held her for, you know, minutes and minutes. And it wasn't until the end of the presentation that the two of them came up to me, and the white woman said, I never knew what I was doing to my friend, who I love. And the black woman, still holding her, said, I love her so much, I didn't have the heart to not be friends, but this has been painful for years. Mm. And it wasn't but 10 minutes after that a different woman came up to me and said, you know, I want to tell you a little something about this colorblindness thing. And what she let me know was that it was really important that the elders that trained me into how to see the world had actually been following directions from a lot of people of color who were telling them during the civil rights era that being colorblind was the right way to go. What she then alerted me to is that I was being very self-critical about how I had been trained, and by extension, criticizing others for something that they had actually been taught to do as part of an effort toward getting over racism, and that as I moved forward, it would be good to acknowledge that.
Right, so I hear you kind of already naming, in a way, this central tension in doing this work as a white person, which is how to look at what is destructive and name it without having to hate yourself, essentially, or hate your elders.
I think that's true, and I think that she was perceptive enough to realize that I was going to lose people that if I wasn't really able to tell the story in a way that didn't hold myself as bad, that it was going to be hard to get other people to go along with the conversation, especially because the effort wasn't bad. The effort around colorblindness has been of positive intention. Now, positive intentions can lead us, you know, toward a whole bunch of a mess. So it's not to say that everything is love and butterflies just because we have a good intention. But to at least acknowledge that we are largely, and I mean, you know, 99% of the people I come in contact with are really invested in doing their best in terms of race and really want to understand better and really believe that this idea of colorblindness is the right way to go. And so it can be a real challenging conversation to tease apart where the positive intention, doesn't actually stop us from enacting hurtful behaviors. That's really hard to hear.
It is. That, I think, is part of why people avoid talking about race, is it feels like such a potential minefield. And we're all afraid of, I think, looking stupid or bad.
Yeah, and I think it's that, and it's another step deeper, too. We don't want to be stupid and bad or be perceived as such. And I would suggest one of the worst things you can say to somebody in our society, especially to a white person, is you're racist. I think it conjures immediately the image of KKK and skinheads and brutal, brutal history that we don't want to associate with. And I think that's completely understandable. And yet, when that mental image goes there and our internal sense of self gets tied up in it, we're really no longer available to a real conversation, because the emotional reactivity, the shame reaction, can be triggered so intently.
All right. This is Feminist Magazine on KPFK Los Angeles. We're listening to Dr. Shelley Touchluck, feminist educator and anti-racist activist.
Right. So how do you explain to someone whose image of racism, you know, is the KKK and the skinheads, how do you explain to someone what kind of modern day, everyday racism is? You know, what, when you said overt racism and less overt racism, what are we talking about by kind of less overt racism? What do you mean?
I think specifically the less overt stuff has a lot to do with very subtle, to me and to other white people, subtle. By the way, I think to people of color, it's completely obvious. But messages that my way is the better way and your way's not.
Right, so we become the reference point, the standard against which everything else is either less than or assumed to be.
Right, and, you know, my own conversations with friends would bear that out. I've got friends that say, well, you know, I'm just normal. You know, I don't have a culture. I'm just a normal person. There's nothing that marks me. I don't have anything that is, you know, there is no ethnicity to my background.
Right. I mean, I went to your blog, Witnessing Whiteness, and I read the essay that you wrote about vanilla, the flavor vanilla, and how you had always grown up thinking vanilla was like not a flavor. It was a base. It was ice cream. And all the other things were flavors. And it feels so the same around whiteness and white norms. I think I grew up very much thinking that, my way was the way, and everything else was something. And it's a profound shift to realize that it's just as much an ethnicity as anything else. Are there reasons why people resist knowing that, do you think? Is there a hidden cost to realizing that whiteness is just as much a flavor, as it were, as anything else?
I think it's really complicated. I think it is one of a really, really huge psychological challenge that requires a deal of healing from the way that race has affected all groups. And I think for white people, we have very specific issues surrounding race. I think the idea of race being sort of a vanilla or plain or not visible, not acknowledged, the norm, part of the trouble with that is that if we do start paying attention to race as culture, paying attention to, or at least white culture and what that might involve, it requires us to go into the history of white supremacy. It just does. And the idea of in any way associating ourselves with that history is just extremely painful if there isn't some other side of the balance that's helping prop us up as viable, positive, worthwhile human beings that are also considered white. And that's where the racial identity piece comes in. I've thankfully run across groups of people that I've been associated with for a really long time that get together and we talk about who we're trying to be as anti-racist individuals, realizing that we've had to, for our own sake, create something of an identity process around becoming anti-racist white people. And as much as we do that, we still have some very unfortunate ties to the history that we continue to benefit from. That's the trouble. So when we talk about why our cities continue to be segregated, it's not accidental, and it's not the fact that people just like living with one another, which tends to be the more individualized, focused explanation. And that's another really big part of how we tend to grow up in the United States. We grow up with a lens of individuals make their choices based only on their own view of the world, and, you know, everybody gets to where they're going to get to based on just their own interests and personality and work and whatnot. But the systemic lens that says actually a lot of people end up where they do in large part, not exclusively, but in large part because we've had systems over time, like GI Bill being differentially, you know, offered, like freeway systems, that at least in LA, there are certain freeway systems that really are helping to connect middle-class neighborhoods. Well, the middle-class neighborhoods have been largely white. So it's a lot of public resource dollars going to help support middle-class families during the 50s, et cetera, that really end up supporting white families more than they do families of color. But because it's not identified as race-based, it doesn't get criticized as such.
We're your hosts, Ceci Abejon and Ariana Mana, and this is Feminist Magazine on KPFK Los Angeles. We're listening to Dr. Shelley Touchluck speaking with Dr. Ann from Safe Space Radio about how to talk race with white people. I hope white progressive activists and the people of color who care about us are listening. Feminism is worthless without intersectionality and inclusion.
So these are all these levels of advantages that for a white person, they're invisible, that they just, you know, they get the GI benefit, they get the loan, and they're not aware necessarily that other people aren't getting it. So they're not even aware of the inequality that's there.
I think that's true. And I'm a teacher educator. And so when I look back at my own education, I wasn't taught any of these less savory aspects of our system or our history.
So I want to come back to white racial identity, because what we're saying is that as we begin to look at this, as we begin to consider ourselves as white people and learn what that means, it invites and almost forces a confrontation with history. And I hear you saying that that can be so painful that it's important to have some kind of balance to that, some kind of antidote where you can also be forming a positive sense of white racial identity in order to bear kind of the awfulness of the history. And I'm curious how you do that. What do you mean when you say that? How do you help people do that?
Well, number one, it's a controversial thing in and of itself, just to note. So many people who are doing anti-racism work really are sick and tired of privileging white people's psychology. And that just has to be acknowledged. That's a completely understandable approach. I mean, there are some people who are just, you know what, white people just need to get over themselves, to stop being self-indulgent and stop worrying about their own emotional health, because this system is, and all of us operating unconsciously within it, is really damaging to other people. So let's just go into it. I spent several years mostly around people of color trying to be useful and supportive and change things. You know, that became a real inspiration for me. But I'll never forget the day when a woman in Watts looked at me and said, you know, Shelley, we got this. We know how to help our kids. We know what we need to do. What we need is for you to go and help the white people understand, so that when our kids grow up and they come knocking on a door looking for opportunity, that there are doors that will open. That was very likely not the first time that I had heard that message before. Go work with the white people. White people need to work with white people. But it's the first time that I was able to hear that message. And I think the reason is because the idea of me going and talking to other white people about this issue was so frightening, so incredibly frightening, because when I look back at it now, what I realize is I didn't know how to have that conversation. I was too fresh from being blind to all of this myself, and so my reactions were either to feel just totally silenced and not have any useful language to offer, or to be really self-righteous and angry, because I was angry at that point. I was angry at my teachers. I was angry at my parents. I was angry at society for not having taught me this stuff earlier. I felt really duped, because I felt at a personal disadvantage of being able to appropriately navigate a diverse environment. And that made me less of a good friend. It made me less of a good colleague to my people of color colleagues. And I hated it. I absolutely hated it. And so it was at that point when I started, you know, looking into this as a serious subject for study. And thankfully, through that, I ended up getting a call one day that said, you know, there's going to be this group forming, and they're a bunch of white people getting together to talk about privilege and talk about how they can be better anti-racist. Like, oh, well, guess where I'm going? So I showed up to the meeting, and I've been going as much as I can monthly for the last 12 years, because that's the space where I found out that I wasn't crazy.
All righty then.
White people need to work with white people.
That's where I learned that other people were going through the same thing I was, in terms of being nervous, being scared, feeling shameful, feeling like there was something I didn't understand that I was feeling resistant to, but I didn't really know what to do about that. And then if I was trying to do something about that, sometimes I got really challenging feedback, and sometimes it was from white people, and sometimes it was people of color. I didn't know how to do this well with anybody. And in sitting in those meetings, you know, slowly but surely, the voice, understanding, nuanced perspective started to emerge that has helped me become a kind of person who can walk into any space with anyone and say, you want to talk about race? We can talk about it. Doesn't mean it's going to be smooth. Doesn't mean it's going to be pleasant. Doesn't mean it's going to be comfortable. And it doesn't mean it's going to feel safe, if safe means being comfortable. But it does mean that I'm willing to show up, stay in the space, even if it gets difficult, recognize that the reactions that are coming from people are coming out of trauma that I think everybody, every group in the United States has suffered in some way, in different ways. But when people are still in reactivity, that's based in injury. And thankfully, over these 12 years, trying to learn a skill set to help me stay non-reactive in the moment, to stay present and stay able to respond to what's going on in that environment, to become curious instead of defensive, has just made all the difference in the world.
Do you feel like being in a kind of all-white support discussion group, do you feel like that has enabled you and probably other people in the group to be honest and to kind of take certain risks about acknowledging some of the unconscious racism that we've learned just growing up in this culture? That, do you feel like you've been able to kind of be more honest without fear of judgment in the same way?
I think that's probably true. I think that it does serve that. I think that the benefit to it that also goes along with it is that we can say these things without injuring the people of color next to us. And that's, I think, the challenge that often comes with multiracial dialogues. And by the way, just because I'm used to this, you know, white space as a value, doesn't mean that it's in as a replacement for meeting in multiracial groups. I think both are really important. The idea of a white affinity space is to say, hey, we need to do this work for ourselves so that we are better able to meet together as diverse multiracial groups.
That makes sense. I mean, it seems to me that you're really respecting the request that was made of you, which is to go do this work among white people. So I don't hear it as an exclusive thing. In some ways, I hear it as a kind of taking responsibility.
That's the effort. The effort is to be responsible. I did have the benefit of having a couple people of color in my life who were amazing teachers, and I wouldn't be where I am today without them. And I also recognize that, you know, there's a lot of white people, and if white people continue to only learn from people of color and make that, well, gee, there's no people of color around, so I can't learn about racism, then we really, as a larger group, aren't going to get very far very fast. And it really puts pressure and a burden on people who really shouldn't be their job. But yes, to have white people gather and say, you know, we can at least get farther with each other than we would on our own. We might be two steps forward and one step back. I think that's often the case. But at least we get farther ahead over time.
I want to end with one last question about being a bystander. I know that you're writing another book, and I read a chapter from it about being a bystander to kind of racial interactions happening, or kind of racism in our society as a whole. And I want to close by asking you to tell me, why is it important for white people? I know this may seem so obvious, but I really want to give you a chance to articulate it. Why is it important for white people to kind of become involved and care about this issue? When it is uncomfortable, when painful feelings come up, what makes it, why is it incumbent upon us to do this?
Beyond the fact that it's the right thing to do, I think it's liberating. I believe that taking up our racial identity in a serious way and digging in and finding out how powerful the social messages have been that have just become infused within us, I believe that it allows us to maneuver, to walk, to engage in our diverse environment in such better ways, to help us avoid doing what none of us want to do, which is to keep injuring people unconsciously. I don't think we want to hurt each other unconsciously. And I think this is such a powerful possibility for being our true best selves in a more conscious way.
Shelley Touchluck, thank you so much for your courage, being willing to be really uncomfortable and talk about it. And I think that kind of greases the skids for all of us to follow in your footsteps. I so appreciate you doing this work. Could you give us your website address? Because I know there's some wonderful discussion guides there that people can use if they want to have their own discussion group.
Sure. The website address is witnessingwhiteness.com, and there's a tab called Workshop Series, and that entire series was built based on requests from others who decided that just sitting alone reading a book wasn't going deep enough. And that series is designed to be useful to either just exclusively white groups of people or multiracial groups. The questions have been thoroughly vetted to really try and dig into what's your personal experience of these issues that the book talks about. And so there are dialogue prompts, and it offers facilitation guides. So, you know, even if you're not normally a diversity facilitator, you can do that for each other and help grow each other as a shared leadership development process.
Shelley Touchluck, thank you so much for being my guest on Safe Space Radio. If you did not get a chance to listen to this whole interview, or you would like to, or you'd like to email a link to your friend, please go to our website, which is safespaceradio.com. There you can subscribe to get a weekly link to that week's show. You can also listen to all our prior podcasts. You can download the show to your smartphone for your morning commute, and you can also write us a comment. We would really love to hear from you. You can also like us on Facebook. You can listen to us through iTunes. My thanks to Gabe Graben for producing the show, and to Jim Russell for being a consultant.
rid of your old gas guzzler? The KPFK Vehicle Donation Program can help. There's still a market for those old vehicles, and if you donate it, you're helping support quality programming. Just call 877-573-5288 or go online at kpfk.org and click on the Pledge Support link. We will take care of everything from free pickup to sending you your tax paperwork. That number again to call is 877-KPFK-AUTO for auto, and we will take care of your old gas guzzler.
Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time.
Sometimes I wish I was blind, because only I could see the true nature of a human being. Oh Lord, I wish I was blind, cause only then there could be a world where color fades and this far in between. My gender, my age, my culture, my nation, under God, protected, uplifted creations. We gotta stand as one voice against the ages of men who destroyed the pages of a book that was sent here to save us. Minds captive, they raised us in chains, enslaved us. And the pain still stains us. And the rain engraved us. But the struggle, it made us. Endurance, outrageous. Oh Lord, I wish I was blind to the fact that we was never free. We tried to let it ring to live in society. Still we sing with one voice in a million harmonies. It's our time to open our eyes and see we are not blind. We are not blind. We will not be silent. We will stand up to the injustice. We will fight for our rights in our communities. Build bridges of peace and unity. I will be set free.
That's called Blind Anti-Racism Song by Roxy Solid and Annie Mae. We're Feminist Magazine, archived at kpfk.org and broadcasting live on KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake, and streaming globally. We're your hosts, Ariana Manoff and Cesse Abejon. In just a few minutes, we'll have performances from award-winning poet Claudia Rankine's adapted play on race in America. But first, we have a couple of events to announce.
All right. First, there's a big African arts and culture event coming up this Friday in support of people specializing in African diasporic arts. Africa in America magazine is hosting the second annual original works showcase entitled Woman Rise Up, Balance. It's choreographed and musically directed by Kara Mack, who has created performances around the power roles of women and the harmony and balance that is created within both the feminine and the masculine.
The program includes performances by 11 dancers, 3 singers, and 11 drummers, all of them reflecting the best of the African diaspora. The evening will culminate with a question and answer session. This event is this Friday, September 11th at 8 p.m. at Barnstall Gallery Theater at 4800 Hollywood Boulevard, Los Angeles, California.
And Frida Fest, named that for Frida Kahlo, of course. Frida Fest is a music and arts festival to empower the lesbian community through the arts. They'll have headliner Irene Diaz performing and also have other music and DJs and spoken word and dance and comedy and visual artists and more.
Frida Fest is happening in Fiesta Hall at Plummer Park, 7377 Santa Monica Boulevard, West Hollywood, California, 90046. You can RSVP info at lprojectla.org.
And now, moving on to the rest of our program, here comes Marina Watanabe, known on the web as vlogger Marina Shut Up. She's a 22-year-old biracial student with lots to say about lots of things.
So some of you might have heard about the Bernie Sanders rally that happened about 2 weeks ago, I think, in downtown Seattle. Basically, several members from the Seattle chapter of the Black Lives Matter movement stormed the stage and took the microphone and refused to let Bernie speak so they could share their message. There's been a lot of disagreements within Black movements because, remember, Black organizations are not monoliths, about whether or not the interruption of Bernie Sanders was a strategic move or if it was unfair to target him, seeing as he's probably one of the most progressive candidates running in the 2016 election. And that's totally fine and probably a good discussion to have. But unfortunately, white progressives and allies have been even more outspoken and critical about this interruption. I've seen and read so many comments from white liberals, even from some of my own family members, saying things like, wow, Black people don't know what's in their best interests. Bernie Sanders is on their side. He marched with Martin Luther King back in the civil rights movement. I mean, that's cool that he, like, wasn't a racist back in the day, but you kind of need to continually show your support and dedication to solving racism. You don't just get your anti-racist badge and you're good to go for the rest of your life. What's frustrating about so many of these comments from white allies, and even allies who are people of color that aren't specifically Black, is that there's this weird sense of paternalism of like, I know what's best for you, and Black people are just being ignorant to what's best for them. Basically, I think this all comes down to respectability politics, which is the idea that if you're not respectable enough or you don't voice your opinion in a way that's considered appropriate to the people in power, then you're not worth supporting. And at the end of the day, it's not about whether or not white liberals like the way that Black movements voice their concerns to the racism that they experience. The idea that the oppressed must conduct themselves in a way that their oppressors find appropriate and palatable is quite frankly oppressive. White allies don't get to decide how Black people and people of color respond to the racism and violence that they experience in their everyday lives. True allies don't offer support only on their terms. Real allies listen and understand and realize that it's not their place to dictate how marginalized people react to their own marginalization. One thing that I find particularly annoying is that white allies will often point to Martin Luther King when they don't like the way that Black people are protesting racism, but without actually understanding what Martin Luther King was about. There's a great quote from him that was mentioned in an article from Everyday Feminism, which I'm gonna link below because it was super useful and echoes many of the same sentiments that I also feel about this whole Bernie Sanders situation. It said, "I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's greatest stumbling block in his stride towards freedom is not the white citizens' counselor or the Ku Klux Klan, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice. Who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. Who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action. Who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom." There's also an article I want to talk about from Mike.com entitled, "I Am the Black Woman Who Interrupted the Netroots Presidential Town Hall, and This Is Why." By the way, there was not just one interruption of Bernie Sanders while he was on stage, but two. Some of you also might have heard of this. It took place during a progressive conference called Netroots Nation on July 18th, where another Black organization called the Movement for Black Lives also organized a storming of the stage. The microphone was taken by a woman named Tia Oso, who used this as an opportunity to talk about the death of Sandra Bland and other Black women who have died in police custody. I'm gonna link this article as well because it's a really interesting read, and it was actually written by Tia Oso herself, where she describes her reasoning for taking the stage and why this movement and talking about police brutality and violence against Black women and Black people in general is so important to her. Another thing that I think is really important as an ally is to make sure you don't talk over the voices of oppressed people who face issues that you yourself don't face. It's important to bring attention to these issues, but it's not your place to dominate the discussion and speak over other people. And I know sometimes it's hard to know where to draw the line, I get that, it's confusing. But I think it's important to remember that Black people, particularly marginalized Black people like Black women, LGBTQ folks, disabled and mentally ill people, these people are often silenced. So with that in mind, I'm gonna end this video with some quotes from the article by Tia Oso that I think just really need hearing. "Sandra Bland and I have a lot in common. We were both Black women, active in our communities, and the movement for Black lives. I've also been harshly confronted by police during routine traffic stops and feared for my safety and my life. I was also determined that Bland's death and name would not be ignored nor dismissed. Saturday's action was powerful. Black organizers claimed our rightful place at the front of the progressive movement. Allies from Latino, Asian, LGBT, and other communities stood in solidarity with us as we called the names of black women killed in police custody, expressed our heartbreaking requests to the community should we ourselves die in police custody, and looked on as respected and revered progressive leaders were woefully unable to answer our reasonable question as to how they will lead America to a brighter future. Anyway, thank you for watching this video. If you enjoyed it, please give it a like and subscribe to this channel.
All right. That was Marina Shut Up. Now, to lead us into our theater feature, we're going to play Adrienne Marie Brown's tribute song called Black Lives Matter. It's the next track on our master CD.
Freedom song, I got to sing my freedom song. I love my people, oh, I love us so. I got my freedom and I won't let go. Black lives matter, black lives matter, black lives matter to me. Your life matters, my life matters, black lives matter to me. Freedom song, I got to sing my freedom song. I love my people, oh, I love us so. I got my freedom and I won't let go because black lives matter, black lives matter, black lives matter to me. Your life matters, my life matters, black lives matter to me. Freedom song, I got to sing my freedom song. I love my people, oh, I love us so. I got my freedom and I won't let go because black lives matter, black lives matter, black lives matter to me. Your life matters, my life matters, black lives matter to me.
All right. Award-winning international director Shirley Jo Finney has directed, among many other things, seven acclaimed Fountain Theater productions, including In the Red and Brown Water, for which she earned her second Ovation Award, The Ballad of Emmett Till, Yellow Man, Central Avenue, and From the Mississippi Delta. You can tell from the titles of those works what her where her interests lie. Now she's back with Claudia Rankine's Citizen, an American Lyric. We caught up with Shirley Jo, rushing to get to the stage, and asked her what makes Rankine's work so important.
Her book is a thought-provoking conversation on race in America, and it is the microaggression that we everyday encounters we have with one another that that we are not aware of. And this book has used vignettes of everyday encounters with racism, remarks, glances, slips of the tongue. This is something people want to do, is have the conversation. And it is a wound, it is America's wound, that we've not had the conversation. And so the show becomes an outlet. Her book was an outlet and has raised people's consciousness and awareness. And we are so much afraid of experiencing and looking at the wound. And her book and now the theatrical production is an opening for that.
We've been joined in studio by actors Nikki Crawford and Monet Michael, who are storming the stage in Citizen. Welcome to Feminist Magazine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So great to see you, especially you, Monet. Oh, boy, I'm
telling you. Apparently you have a history together, and they've been exchanging sort of glances about, oh, we know stuff.
Nikki and Monet, you won, Monet. Nikki, you've won the NAACP Theater Award for Best Actress and an LA Ovation nomination and for Best Featured Actress in a portrayal of a young Lena Horne in Stormy Weather at the Pasadena Playhouse.
Yes.
And Monet Michael, wow. You were nominated for an NAACP Theater Award for your role as Tanya in King Hedley III at the Mark Taper Forum. And you describe yourself as an actress and an entrepreneur with work spanning TV, film, theater, animation, commercials, and motherhood.
Oh, I guess Leslie put that in there.
I would have thought that would be top of the list as far as time. All right, let's jump right into this. Please, let's hear an excerpt from Citizen, an American Lyric.
Great. 2 years later, Serena is playing in the U.S. Open final. She's expected to win.
Some speculate Serena especially wants to win this Grand Slam because it is the 10th anniversary of the attack on the Twin Towers.
It's believed that by winning, she will prove her red-blooded American patriotism and will once and for all become beloved by the tennis world.
Think Arthur Ashe, after his death.
All the bad calls, the boos, the criticisms, that she has made ugly the game of tennis.
Through her looks as well as her behavior.
That entire cluster of betrayals will be wiped clean with this win.
The umpire rules correctly that Serena, by shouting,
Come on! Interfered with Stozer's concentration.
A ball that Stozer seemingly would not have been able to return becomes Stozer's point? Are you trying to screw me again?
Is this the same umpire? It isn't.
Aren't you the one that screwed me over last time here?
Serena's frustrations, her disappointments exist within a system you understand not to try to understand, because to do so is to understand the erasure of the self as ordinary.
Yeah, you are. Don't look at me.
For Serena, the daily diminishment is a low flame, a constant drip.
Really? Don't even look at me.
Every look, every comment, every bad call blossoms out of history through her onto you.
Who would do such a thing? Don't look my way.
To understand is to see Serena as hemmed in as any other black body thrown against our American background.
I am not the one. Look my way.
But who can turn away? Serena's not running out of breath. Despite all her understanding, she continues to serve up aces while smashing rackets and fraying hems.
Wow. All right.
Wow.
What can we say about that kind of illumination of things that people may not even be aware of as they are enjoying the predominantly white game of tennis?
Mm. That's a really good point. Claudia brought this to my mind. This is Monet talking. I wasn't even aware of this with Serena. I do watch tennis, but I haven't been watching it for a while. One of the great things about her writing is that she brings to light things that we experience in everyday life, but not necessarily are aware that we are experiencing. And so I think she has this thing about athletes in general, in black athletes in the white world, and how they, what their world is like day after day, having to represent the race, you know, be extra above fault, and just the inbred and tacit and also unconscious racism that they experience.
Especially her in the world of tennis, which is so, you know, excuse
as
me,
play but says,
lily white,
right.
You know.
And it was overt in the beginning. It was so overt. I mean,
it's
they
still
criticized
overt.
The braids.
Yeah,
you know,
everything. Her body, right, the way she
junk
looks.
Junk in the trunk. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Absolutely. And I think that both of them, Serena and Venus, have handled themselves
courage.
Exceptionally
taking
well.
The high road and being
oh,
very courageous.
Oh, absolutely. I'm, they couldn't make me prouder.
Right?
I mean, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. This afternoon, we're having what could be a socially awkward conversation about race. And right now, we're focusing on Jamaican-born poet Claudia Rankine's sensational book, Citizen, which has been adapted for the stage by Stephen Sachs from the Fountain Theater.
Yeah.
Now, what was it like to rehearse this material, including your reaction to the piece you just read? Were you nodding and sort of going, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Ooh.
I don't think I can say exactly.
Oh, come on.
No, I can't curse on the air. But, I mean, her work is brilliant. It was, Monet and I had a very short rehearsal process because we were stepping in. And literally 4 days with the cast is all we had. And this is not a normal play. And this is, language is extremely lofty. It's it's poetry. Yes. And so trying to make sense of it in a theatrical way, as well as just getting your mouth around the words and then memorizing. And memorizing, you know, that's something that we have to do all the time. But this is, you know, some of these words are not in they're not in context to a particular scene, so it's not as easy to memorize in that way. And then certainly with, you know, the shortened rehearsal process, it was difficult, but it's incredible, and I'm so excited to see the audience's reaction and the different types of reaction. Yeah. And it's it's incredible. Her words are so powerful.
One of the extraordinary things about the cast, I went to see the play before I stepped in and saw and said yes, is the excellent work, the camaraderie, the teamwork, the ensemble work that's portrayed by everyone. And so, honestly, there in rehearsals, never race did not come up as a I-they thing. It was a group effort, attacking, if you will, presenting this piece. And there was no, like, oh, I wonder how, you know, they feel about me saying this. It's just such a group wonderful activity. I know one of the other cast members who was white at the beginning of her rehearsal process felt very like, oh, am I the bad guy? You know, how to portray, because a lot of it is written
right
with all of it is written from the black perspective.
Right.
There's no
right
kind of leniency there.
Right.
So she did have some integration, but it's such a wonderful cast. Mm.
And, you know, honestly, that's what I was slightly concerned about with the piece initially. I mean, I respect the fact that, you know, Claudia wrote it from that perspective, and she does so unapologetically.
Right.
You know, but sometimes, especially if you know, a certain race of people are feeling any type of guilt, they may, their ears may shut down if it's thrown, you know,
sure,
jammed down their
sure
throats. But it was done in such a great way that it's not. And initially, that was some of my concerns.
And I think that's credit to Stephen Sacks.
Absolutely.
Who choreographed this, if you will, who wrote it, rather, and Shirley Jo, who did it.
Definitely.
And it's a collaboration of your ensemble as well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And it takes being vulnerable and being willing to dance and do that whole dance.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. We have time for one more quick excerpt from Citizen and American Lyric.
Yay.
Okay. So go for it.
Okay.
Sometimes I can hear my own voice saying silently to whomever, "You are saying this thing, and I am not going to accept it. I refuse to carry what doesn't belong to me."
You take in things you don't want. All the time.
Some ordinary moment.
All its intended targets.
All the meanings come into focus.
Hold up.
Did you just hear?
Did you just say?
Did you just see?
Did you just do that?
Then the voice in your head silently tells you to
take your foot off your throat.
Because just getting along shouldn't be an ambition.
Wow.
Wow.
Woo.
Nikki Crawford and Monet Michael, thank you so much for joining us for this edition of Feminist Magazine.
Thank you.
We want to let our listeners know that Citizen, an American Lyric, continues through October the 11th. We're doing a ticket giveaway for this fabulous, fabulous production as a benefit for you listening for Feminist Magazine this afternoon. We have 3 pairs of tickets available, 3 pairs for Sunday, October 4th at 7 o'clock, and 3 pairs for Monday, October 5th at 8 o'clock. Give us a call right here, right now at 818-985-5735. That's 818-KPFK. We are pulling this on you last minute. Ceci is going to go into the phone room right now to take your call. She'll let you know one way or the other if we can give you a pair of tickets. And once again, we want to thank G for engineering, a shout out to the good folks at Fountain Theater, and to Dr. Ann Hallward from Safe Space Radio, Marina Watanabe from Feminist Fridays, and Lynn Harris-Ballin, who gave us behind the sound support. Check out our website at www.feministmagazine.org with all the links to the people featured in this program. You can find us on Facebook or on Twitter at FemMagKPFK. Their music today was by Santa Gold and Adrian Brown and Rox with a Z Solid with Annie May. Feminist Magazine is created by a collaboration of feminist volunteers, produced, We produce this program, which is stored in the KPFK org audio archive. Sorry, I'm losing my place here. I wanted to add that I'm totally lost here. American Lyric is playing on Saturdays at 8 o'clock and Sundays at 3 o'clock and at 7 p.m. and Mondays, yes, Mondays at 8, when you can pay what you can at the Fountain Theater. For more information, you can call 323-663-1525 or go to fountaintheater.com if you want to see it, because da-da-da-da, this show is selling out. All right. To quote Maya Angelou, the need for change bulldozed a road down the center of my mind. I can relate.
This month, the Jazz Bakery's Movable Feast Series launches its fall season with a lineup of heavy hitters. First, French-American pianist Jackie Terrison appears on Friday, September 11th at Zipper Concert Hall downtown. On Saturday, September 19th, organ maestro Joy DeFrancesco headlines the Moss Theater at the Herb Alpert Educational Village in Santa Monica. Then, on Friday, September 25th, the annual Angel City Jazz Festival kicks off with a free concert at LACMA, introduced by Jazz Bakery president Ruth Price. Bakery and festival events continue through October with Yosvani Terry, Baptiste Trotignon, Mark Dresser, John Beasley's Monkestra, Monk Institute Jazz Ensemble, Alex Klein, Alan Broadbent, and Charles Lloyd's Wild Man's Dance. For more info, visit kpfk.org or call the Jazz Bakery hotline at 310-271-9039.
Hi, Maggie LaPique. When you have a chance, would you be kind enough to call me and tell me what a hoopty is? That's a great ad, but I didn't understand the word hoopty. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Okay. So many of you out there have been calling and saying, sure, I'll donate my hoopty to KPFK, but what's a hoopty? Well, in line with KPFK's mission statement, and I paraphrase, to engage in activity that shall contribute to a lasting understanding between the individuals of all nations, races, creeds, and colors, Maggie and I will now translate from the African-American into the Anglo. A hoopty is a junker.
A clunker.
A jalopy.
Chitty chitty bang bang.
A lemon.
A bucket of bolts.
A heap.
A rattle trap.
A bucket.
A gas guzzler.
A pinto.
A gremlin.
So look out the window at your driveway. Go ahead, look. If any of the above mentioned are in your driveway, consider donating that hoopty to KPFK.
You can do that by calling 877-573-5288, and we'll take care of the details.
You can also visit kpfk.org and click on the Donate Your Vehicle button.
Hi, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly citizen, investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow from bradblog.com. Join me for The Bradcast every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. 1 hour of troublemaking and muckraking ripped from the pages of bradblog.com and sometimes from the dark recesses of my mind. We'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers, we'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys if we can find any. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. We'll report on politics, elections, election reform, mainstream corporate media failure, media reform, global warming denialism, and everything before, during, and after. Join me for The Bradcast every Wednesday, now a full hour, 3 to 4 p.m., right here on Pacifica Radio's KPFK and coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org.